This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Richard Carpiano, a professor of public policy and sociology at the University of California, Riverside. Richard is a medical sociologist and public health policy scholar with a ton of work to his credit. He does work in a bunch of areas, including more recent work on under-vaccination. He and Nicholas Fitz, recently published Public Attitudes Towards Child Under Vaccination, a randomized experiment on evaluations, stigmatizing orientations, and support for public policies in social science and medicine. It's a really good article. I enjoyed it. A great piece of medical sociology, and I look forward to talking about it. It's a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, let's start. Maybe you could start us off by, giving us a sense of what the controversy is surrounding vaccination and anti-vaxxers. Who are they? What's going on?
Anti-vaxxers, is the common parlance that gets used in a lot of different ways, but empirically really represent a rather small population, a small but yet very vocal minority of the larger population of concern of what we would call vaccine hesitant parents in terms of. So vaccine hesitancy can capture anything from somebody having some sorts of concerns, maybe about one or more vaccines for their child. They might delay having concerns of a child getting too many vaccines all at one time, versus when we talk about, or even in general, could just be someone who goes through the motions, gets their child vaccinated, but is, generally maybe not on board in terms of, or has some significant sorts of questions in regards to safety or other maybe sort of side effects that might emerge as a result of vaccinating their child. Versus the anti-vaxxer who is generally would be someone, a parent whose child has no vaccines or at some point maybe started vaccinating their child and then stopped as a result of not any number of different reasons, but we can attribute them to where this is really still a rather emerging literature. But we know that the influences of this get very heavily tied around networks, information that's found on the web, and then also more broadly, science that was that's been debunked. That it was a major study many years ago by now a discredited physician by the name of Andrew Wakefield, who published a piece in The Lancet, so a rather prominent, one of the most prominent international medical journals, postulating a link between the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine that young children receive, and autism. That ultimately, when investigated, was found to be fraudulent in terms of, and unethical in terms of how the analysis was conducted, and based on a very small sample of children, and ultimately his authors decided to not stand behind it, and the Lancet ultimately decided to retract the article. Yet, what's interesting is that finding caught fire and has persisted for a long time, although it's now. This has really kind of caught fire, and so we had the historically, if we kind of track this sort of historically, we had certain sort of prominent celebrities who were getting behind this and concerned about it. Jenny McCarthy being probably one of the most prominent about this. So over time, the whole vaccine hesitancy or even an anti-vaxxer activism is not a new thing. That's always sort of existed. But to the extent to which we see it now and the ways and media and even sort of just online, the internet enables sort of a more vocal, sort of active resurgence in a way is rather important. While we might think of these as a very small group of the vaccine hesitancy population, the consequences of their actions really are rather significant.
There's been outbreaks, haven't there?
Yeah, so in terms of outbreaks, and so often we look at these. You can it starts to become a bit of a numbers game. If you look at sort of reports about states or the nation in terms of how many children are vaccinated, the numbers look really quite good to maintain herd immunity, which would be the idea that if you vaccinate enough people within a population, that they can provide a certain protection to those who can't be protected from it. Either they're too young or they're immunocompromised, or some people even have legitimate allergies to or reactions to certain vaccines. But to the extent to which these so while these numbers look big and everything looks protected, we know, well, really it's these are infectious diseases, they're communicable, and so it's about who you see in your day-to-day. And fundamentally, this is a sociological problem in the sense that we have vaccine hesitancy clustering in particular communities and within particular schools. And so as a result, this really sets the sort of groundwork or the potential for for these types of outbreaks. Compounding that also are in many states we have vaccination is not mandatory. That there are options to exempt out of it as a result of some sort of philosophical or religious type of exemption in certain states. Only three states actually make it a requirement for enrollment. A lot of talk about California initiating it, but actually it's West Virginia and Mississippi were the leaders in this, which is, I kind of laugh as a public health scholar, because generally when you think of those two states, you don't think of them as public health leaders on many things. But in terms of taking action on that, that had been that is something that's been going on. But I digress.
Interesting.
With the rise, we've also been seeing, so not only just this sort of rise in sentiment, rise in activism, but also sort of a rise in these opting out exemptions, which is also enables some of the, or sets at least the potential for a lot of these vaccinations or a lot of these outbreaks to occur. But for I guess for the average listener who's like, okay, public health wonk here talking about something that's important to him and whatnot. I mean, this what I find really fascinating about this whole issue is, as more broadly as a sociologist, is really how the anti-vaccine movement and even vaccine hesitancy in general. And some of my work has been within the United States. I focus a significant amount of it in Canada too, and see some interesting similarities as well. Is really how this applies to sort of more broader sociological issues about information or misinformation or and even campaigns, the role of networks in circulating them, and even how some of these things get tied into broader political issues regarding populist politics and the role of a more sort of libertarian sort of streak that you might see. And so really this is, I mean, I could be talking with you about this, or you could make this about an eight podcast series. So maybe I should stop there and let you guys jump in.
You know what? It's actually the perfect setup for my next question, which is, so like, tell us about your study, because it was involving public perceptions and public reaction,
Absolutely.
which is very important.
Well, we look at these. Well, there's so much attention that's paid to who's not vaccinating, because journalists cue in on that, and obviously to many people that might seem sort of unusual. It's counterintuitive. Vaccinations are considered to be one of the greatest public health achievements. If you were to take Public Health 101, it would make a top 10 list of one of the greatest accomplishments of public health. Sanitation and other things. So it does seem rather counterintuitive, and so the stories will definitely focus in on that. What's not a news story is the fact that most parents go and get their child vaccinated, and maybe there's a little bit of crying, but otherwise it's not really much of an event. And so when I was telling people that this is, I became fascinated sort of just when the California outbreak had occurred, the Disneyland measles outbreak occurred. And that's really how I started getting into this as an issue. And as I started getting into projects and I would talk with people about what it is that I study and the current things I'm looking at, I would notice, I would tell people before, and I study health disparities, and it would be, well, tell me more about what that's all about, sort of thing. But this was something that particularly I noticed really hit a nerve with people. Oh, those people are nuts. Those people are crazy. Oh, I can't believe that, that people would do, they better stay away from my child, And And so to me, it was just really fascinating to think about, sir, what is the average public perception of this versus the studying always about what does an anti-vaxxer think and react and how we might sort of counter that. And there's so much sociological literature about sort of public perceptions about mental illness and about stigma. And really a lot of those ideas really do translate to this, but now looking in this case at an infectious disease.
So Richard, can you give us an overview of your study? What were you looking for? What were the questions? How'd you do it?
Yeah, so my study, and I have to give a lot of credit to my co-author, Nick Fitz, who is just was a whiz with MTurk and these designs. He's now pursuing his doctorate in psychology at Duke. Having said that, this is really sort of out of a tradition of vignette studies that had been done in medical sociology and the sociology of mental health to try to measure sort of public attitudes regarding illness and sort of the social construction in essence of illness. And what we tried to do here is we created a number of different vignettes that we randomized to present to people. In this case, this was a response on Amazon's MTurk throughout the United States. And they were presented with four different vignettes, one of four different vignettes, one of which characterized a mother who was completely, was very concerned about vaccinations and in terms of their safety, and has decided not that her child is not vaccinated at all. One situation where the mother has some concerns, but as a result has decided to delay some vaccinations. Third where mother thinks that vaccinations are important, but life happens as a parent, and as a result, the child's not up to date as a result of just sort of competing demands. And then a fourth condition where the mother thinks that vaccinations are really quite important, and as a result, ensures that her child is up to date whenever a vaccination is due. After being exposed to one of those four vignettes, we gave the respondents a number of different measures that we adapted from a lot of the literature on stigma towards mental illness in terms of trying to get at people's attributions about the parent, to what degree they might blame the mother if the child got sick or others sick. The degree to which they might be angry or have sympathy for the mother. The degree to which they felt that there was sort of a need for separation, that there was sort of a characterization or a boundary sort of being drawn of sort of an us versus them sort of about mothers like the one that got described, as well as sort of assessments about the mother's sort of credibility in terms of thinking about information or advice that she might have to offer about parenting or about health issues of the child, and then also just to perceive sort of dangerousness that the parent might have. And then we also have some questions about the degree to which the respondent might want to be distance themselves or not, you know, sort of live in this either the same community or interact with either both the mother and as well as we had separate questions for the child as well, as well as some questions around discrimination too, that they should be kept out of things or this mother should be hired. You know, we even went to some sort of extreme sorts of examples about social exclusion. What we found was very stark, which was actually sort of surprising to me, is the degree to which this really did fall in a gradient, in the sense that respondents most strongly reacted to the kind of traditional anti-vaxxer sort of description of a parent with a child who was not up to date on any of them intentionally. And then next to that, next strongest would be then the delayer to the, and then a little bit more nuanced, but still some negativity towards the mother who is just encountering just challenges in making the doctor's appointments and getting the child up to date. So in addition to that, but on top of that, what we found was equally or in some cases stronger reactions towards the mother's child, which was also interesting to thinking about sort of a In this case, stigma by association, perhaps, but also in the case of, you know, it's the child's sort of, I guess, potential for carrying disease. We can think about this in just sort of almost like the out of like classic literature or the Bible, the idea of like sort of avoiding the person who could be the carrier, in that regard. More broadly, though, in terms of thinking about policy and where to go with this in these findings, were that we found that these reactions were very strongly tied to the types of policies that these respondents would endorse or get behind. So we presented them with a range of options that span from rather benign things like that most people could probably get behind, such as, you know, more education or is needed, more public education is needed, to things that were very much, you know, very severe. To things that were sort of on the books. So things like banning a child from school, like what would occur in California, or at that time period was on the books for being voted on. So that's the other thing to put this a little bit in context. We were catching a bit of a zeitgeist in terms of the news cycle, but then also some more extreme sorts of policies that were getting promoted or proposed or later implemented, even such as in relation to denying certain sorts of social benefits if a child to a parent or if household if a child is not up to date. And ultimately, what we were finding there is that the more sympathetic that somebody was, essentially, the general pattern was the more sympathetic that someone was towards a parent, the more they were towards these kind of more lighter or softer sorts of policies. Public reporting of school coverage would be another example of that. And then the more strongly that they reacted to the parent and to the child, the more likely they were to be moving towards these much more sort of heavier-handed sorts of policies. Definitely, from an anti-vaxxer standpoint, be viewed as very, much more, very heavily intrusionist. Sometimes gets couched in rhetoric of anti-American or anti-freedom or unlibertarian, yeah. I guess you could say.
Yeah. So Richard, I really enjoyed the article.
Thank you very much.
And one of the things that got me thinking about was whether or not you think like stigma would have varied based on what vaccine or which vaccines you were talking about, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, like I think a lot about the HPV vaccine, mm-hmm. right? And number one, I actually think that like all boys should have to take it. And I don't think girls should have to take it at all because we then have to go on and take toxic oral contraceptives, right? Right? So we already have these things going on. So why not put the onus on boys since boys are the ones who transmit it, mm-hmm. yeah. right? But we don't do that. So I was wondering whether or not you thought you would see different effects, right, in terms of like sort of like the sort of size, like the effect of like stigma actually being a thing. Number one, because we're talking about something that's associated with something that is very often stigmatized in our society, both sex and also sexually transmitted diseases, right? Although the way in which HPV is framed more as a sort of cancer preventative vaccine, right? So I was wondering whether or not you'd see like some similar effects there and whether or not you think you might see gender effects there, right?
Yeah, no, that's such a great question. And the short answer to that is I would definitely think that we would see effects about that.
Will you do the study?
Any funders listening?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, definitely for all the high uptake that we see for sort of the standard or the more established sort of child vaccinations, you know, it's a definitely a different story for the HPV vaccine. And there is a lot tied into this idea that, I think a bit of a stigma around the idea that, well, you can get it through sexually transmitted, through sexual transmission. And so therefore, I'm giving this to my daughter. Well, now, at least in some localities, boys as well, but giving it at a young age. And, so this idea that, I mean, certainly among some families, there was concern that, and this has now been debunked quite nicely, I think, with studies. But this sort of concern that, well, if we give this to kids, kids are going to mistakenly think it's some license to go have sex, that they might think that they're sort of super protected and whatnot. And we know that definitely hasn't occurred. So that's a misconception. But also, I think it hits on, I mean, ultimately, these are very heavily parental decisions. And parents, it's to think about their, 12, 14-year-old, thinking about, let's talk about sex, or even now the age has been moved down in certain jurisdictions of when it gets
to like 11.
Yeah. And so, my sweet little child, I have to think of them now as sort of this sexual being, it's certainly discomforting for a parent. And so, that's certainly going to undermine the uptake of it as well. So I make a long story short, I would not be surprised if the findings were very different for that, for that particular vaccination.
Richard, I was really fascinated with your study, and I like that you used vignettes and you're looking at social distance and you're looking at how people relate to one another. But I do a lot of work with policymakers, and what I was curious about is, there's a thing in policy where people say 1, 3, and 25, that the intern reads the 25 report, page report, they make a 3-pager that they send to their boss, who then makes a 1-pager that sends it to the decision maker. And so I was wondering, like, in terms of policy, how do you see that 1-pager, what is the intervention that this is leading to that you think will make the most effective change here?
Well, this is where it gets complicated in terms of thinking about the whole about this particular issue about under vaccination and vaccine hesitancy in general. It's good in general to be thinking about sort of what would be public support behind different policies if support moves one way or another. And we have extended this to looking at within British Columbia, in terms of public attitudes towards different sorts of policies, not in this sort of experimental situation, but just sort of looking just more broadly at sort of what people might be supporting and whatnot. But what I try to bring up in the discussion section of the paper, and this is where things get much more sort of challenging and more controversial, that I guess you could say to be thinking about is. As sociologists, we generally think of stigma as quite a bad thing, usually, in terms of labor being applied to a particular group and being outcast and whatnot. Within public health ethics, there's been a little bit more of a revision of this issue, in the sense that one person particularly comes to mind would be the work of Ronald Baer, who is an HIV ethicist. Obviously, in that case, stigma would be terrible, it was a terrible approach in terms of thinking about different types of interventions for that particular disease. But at the same time, sort of brings up, which is widely recognized within public health, the stigmatization of cigarette smoking worked quite well. And so does that mean, to what degree is stigma is sort of an ethical, is there an ethical basis of using stigma as a public policy, lever, essentially? In this case, we kind of try to weigh those issues and try to thinking about them, the potential to be pushing people sort of underground in this case and not getting, not converting. If the goal is to try to get as high as possible coverage, would that really be would that be the most effective sort of solution to be bringing up, bring campaigns that really have sort of a bit more of a, I vaccinated my child, why haven't you? And really sort of putting the onus on and turning it around towards the anti-vaxxers and shining a lens on that versus the other sorts of options that might be what gets discussed in this still emerging literature and debate and discussion around things such as, well, just focus on these more, less of sort of severe hesitant parents who are sometimes referred to as sort of the fence sitters, convert those and that should be enough to be able to maintain what we need. And so there's not a straightforward with this paper policy prescription with it. It's more, but what we were trying to do with it was really trying to capture this, trying to bring sort of the other side to it of, whereas so much is always focused on, again, this, these, the anti-vaxxer, the vaccine, or the vaccine hesitant population itself is, what exactly are the attitudes towards these people where it's sort of, that, that might take it for granted that, you know, I do this for my kid, or that parents do this for their children, and are generally, we know from public surveys that generally the vast majority of the public is on board with the utility of vaccination. And so kind of where does this attitudinal sort of fault line sort of stand was really sort of where we were going with this paper.
No, that's really the cool part of it. You know, it made me think of all kinds of ideas. On the one hand, it made me think of the Chinese saying of kill the chicken to scare the monkey. Or in other words, you know, there's evidence that you find that basically people are okay with stigmatizing the people who are refusing. Therefore, you might be able to have some impact on harsher policies or using stigmatization to scare away the people who are kind of thinking about it but aren't committed. But then on the other hand, I thought to myself of when I was a kid in the 80s and a teenager, and those commercials of with the eggs, and here's your brain, and then they crack it and fry it on the fry pan, and here's your eggs on drugs. And we just legalized cannabis in Canada. So that didn't really work on the soft drugs. So, you know, so this is the kind of stuff I began thinking about and where I was kind of pushing you to see where you might be thinking about in terms of how this would be used.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It really is really amazing how such a small group can be so vocal. And really what we are seeing on the policy side of it is how impactful they really can be in undermining efforts to maintain the public's health, in terms of even just some fairly basic sorts of measures, such as, say, public reporting so that parents are aware of, you know, within their school, how their school kind of fares, or different schools, how that gets challenged, or different, you know, in Texas, we know that there's certain candidates that, you know, they'll get behind and they'll support. And so this is, I really think we are sort of still only at the relative tip of the iceberg. And I hate to say it, but I think things are going to get worse going along. I'm not the only person saying that. The support, I mean, you can see it from a social movements lens too. I mean, I always say that there's a great dissertation to be written here too in that regard. I mean, so much of the public media stories are always about this mom here, and, you know, and these are often our mothers who are making sort of appearances, and we know that mothers tend to make the majority of the health decisions for a child. But in terms of the actual sort of organized collective grassroots sorts of efforts, it really is quite amazing the pull that they can have. And even to the extent to which they get media coverage gives the public conception that they are much more numerous in size than what they are. Challenging, you know, coming back and fighting that, particularly in you know, the internet age where people have, you know, the PhD in Google, or, you know, they can access a scholar or a clinician online and Twitter and try to engage them, and or even sponsor panels. I fell into this when we were, I was talking about this with a number of vaccination researchers and clinicians. Getting invitations to panels that were essentially stacked with anti-vaxxers and serve as a tactic of sort of legitimating sort of their cause, because they're on the same sort of panel as I consider myself a legit scientist. So all these sorts of different ways that they come about, and tactics that they employ, really present some different challenges, and ultimately have, in some countries, have resulted in, like Australia, you know, taking some rather strong measures, such as their no jab, no pay policy, where denying different sorts of tax benefits to families if their child's not up to date, for instance, and seeing that, and now, or in the other case, retrenchment, I guess you could say, in terms of vaccination policy in Italy. And we're seeing, which is now, along with a lot of Europe, in a wave of a major measles epidemic.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.